Hello, this is Jennifer Joyner from the Triangle Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from Ghosts from the Coast, a ghostly tour of coastal North Carolina and South Carolina by Nancy Roberts. So sit back, grab a blanket, and try not to be scared. Chapter 5, The Ghost of Station 6, Black Pelican Restaurant, Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This story is about a dark episode in the history of one of the 7 life-saving stations built along the Outer Banks. Lifesavers, although lacking professional training in the 1870s, and often the rescue equipment they badly needed, were legendary for their bravery. But they were also very human, subject to anger, jealousy, and that fierce pride the sea so often breeds in men. Old Station 6, later transformed into a restaurant called the Black Pelican, still retains part of the early building, its photographic history, and its ghost. In 1884, James R. Hobbs was the keeper of Station 6. He was a man accustomed to respect from his life-saving crew, and when he gave orders, he expected instant obedience. The crew's lives and those of the shipwreck victims were at stake each time they launched their small craft into the raging sea. It was rare for there to be any serious disagreements, but in July of 1884, antagonism erupted between Hobbs and a young surfman named T.L. Daniels. The dislike that sturdy, broad-shouldered Hobbs and surfman Daniels felt for each other ran deep. Daniels, a tall, handsome fellow with curly brown hair, was ready enough to go out in the boats when a shoaled ship and its passengers' lives were at stake. But a roguish smile often lurked in his eyes and curled the corners of his mouth, announcing to the world that he neither needed nor wanted orders from anyone. This attitude so irritated Keeper Hobbs that it made him watch Daniels with a more critical eye than he did any of the other men. Daniels soon noticed this, and it brought out all the little rebellious ways to which he was by nature prone. If the keeper had been a more perceptive man and Daniels less cocky, the surfman might have gained maturity under Hobbs, who was an excellent seaman. But that was not to be, and finally, the dislike the two men harbored for each other loosed its moorings. Hobbs had an attractive wife of whom he was inordinately jealous, and whenever he imagined that the young surfman stared at Mrs. Hobbs overly long, the captain would retaliate by treating him harshly. Daniels noticed this weakness and began to play upon it in many subtle ways. On one occasion, someone was needed to take Mrs. Hobbs home from the scene of a shipwreck where she had been watching the rescue. As fate would have it, Daniels was the one to escort her home in a carriage. While he did so, he was chewing tobacco, and because of carelessness or the direction of the strong wind, he accidentally spat tobacco juice upon the full skirt of Mrs. Hobbs' dress. She told her husband about it. Early the next day, rescue work continued. But when it grew too dark to put out the boats, the exhausted crew all walked back to Station 6 for a drink. Here the captain angrily rebuked Daniels for the incident in the carriage. "Your wife would need to worry about keeping her skirts clean if she handled them like a lady," was Daniels' crude retort. This insult to his wife so infuriated Keeper Hobbs that he reached for his revolver on the mantel, took aim, and before the horrified eyes of the men, shot Daniels dead. Blood spattered everywhere, on the station floor, on the wall. In a state of shock, Mrs. Hobbs began to wipe it up with the help of some of the life-saving crew. The surfmen discussed in hushed tones the problem of what to do with the body. The wind had abated, so they decided to row it out in one of the boats and bury it at sea. Back from their grisly task, they slept briefly and reported to the station just before dawn. There was no outside observer, and no law enforcement within miles in these early years of the life-saving service. So the surfman's testimony and the keeper's, together with that of his wife, cleared Captain Hobbs. But according to many who have owned or worked in old Station 6, the spirit of the impudent young surfman is still there. In recent years, the station has become a popular restaurant. A couple dining at the Black Pelican in June of 1999 talked with wait persons who claimed to have had their own experiences with the ghost. Two former owners have seen enough to be convinced. When Mimi Adams of Kitty Hawk first bought the old station for a restaurant, she was well aware of the tales that had been told for years about Station 6. Claire Sutton, who owned it when it was a bed and breakfast, said to me, "Mimi, maybe I should tell you something about that place," and I said, "Claire, if you're going to say there is a ghost there, I've already met him." I was sitting at the bar, and only one guy had come to work. We were trying to get the restaurant open. Suddenly, all the lights, refrigerator, cooling system, everything came on. "There's got to be someone here," my new employee said, his face white. "There's got to be a ghost." "That's got to be hogwash," I said, and at that moment a heavy bar stool near me overturned, and a gust of icy air rushed past. That was my introduction to the ghost of Station 6. From then on, I knew something was really there. An attractive, energetic woman, whose hair is tinged with chestnut, Mrs. Adams talks about her years as owner of the Black Pelican restaurant with nostalgia. "We specialized in fine seafood dishes and a distinctive atmosphere. I decorated the old station with reproductions of early black and white photographs depicting the rich history of the Outer Banks." Mrs. Adams describes the house where the station keeper and his wife once lived as a tiny place on Kitty Hawk Road over on the north side, near where the old post office used to be. A girl who once worked for me lived in it. She told me the house was haunted, and said sometimes in the small hours of the night we would wake up to hear raised voices coming from the loft above. They always sounded like a man and woman quarreling. On and on they would go, but the words were never distinct enough to be understood. The young woman always wondered if the keeper and his wife were arguing about his murder of Daniels. "The old part of the restaurant is where it occurred," continued Mimi Adams. "That is where the life-saving station once was. When I owned it, the wait staff would vacuum in there at the end of the evening. As they cleaned the carpet, their vacuums would often turn off mysteriously. The same thing would happen at the keeper's house, so I began to feel that the ghost must hate the sound of a vacuum. One night I entered the dining room while the cleaning was going on, and suddenly the tablecloths began billowing as if lifted by a gale wind. Then our hanging plants began to swing wildly, yet not a window was open. This often occurred at closing time. On the other hand, I would sometimes arrive early in the morning at the empty building and walk into a bathroom where I heard the toilet flush just in time to see the water swirling down the commode. The bar was one of the ghost's favorite places. I may as well call him Mr. Daniels. He's the only one I can imagine it being. Tammy, one of my bartenders, would have all the ashtrays cleaned, washed, and upside down at the end of the bar before she left. Several times she saw the ashtrays right themselves and go sliding down the gleaming wood of the bar. Tammy knew that he was around. For a while, we had overheard glasses hanging from a rack above the bar. The bartender once reached up and got a glass, placing it on the little rubber mat. From an upright position, the glass did a complete somersault. About 10 customers saw it, and they were stunned. They were all saying things like, "What kind of magic do you do in this place?" I wondered myself. One night the bar was so busy that I had two bartenders working. The space was narrow, and they had to say excuse me every time they passed each other. The male bartender said to the girl, "Just a second, I'll move out of your way." Then he called out to her, "Let go of my shoulder." It was like a comic movie because she was nowhere near him. She was at the opposite end of the bar. And that's the way the ghost of Station 6 behaves. He was a brazen, sassy sort of fellow anyway. I was always told that Surferman Daniels was murdered in the old part of the station, and that does seem to be where he is most active. He was shot by Keeper Hobbs in the back room at the south end of the building. The first year I owned the Black Pelican, I kept the old carpet, planning to replace it later. It had a spot that the cleaning person would wash away, but that always returned. One morning I pointed out to a wait person that a customer had spilled a decanter of red wine on the carpet beside one of her tables. "That red stain appears fresh," said I. She stared at me and said, "Mimi, nobody at that table drank red wine all night." I discovered that every time it rained, the stain appeared, and I heard later that the table had been part of the furniture in the old station. Mimi gazed out at the ocean in front of the Black Pelican as if her thoughts were far away. "I always wanted to set the ghost free, so at one time I found someone to exorcise it. They said it had to be done on the night of the darkest moon, and the date that fell upon was to be a night the week before Christmas. I was reluctant to do it that close to a sacred holiday, and soon began to have misgivings about having it done at all." Mrs. Adams paused. By then, the supernatural events in the Pelican had become the natural. "Some years later, I sold the restaurant in order to retire, but from all I hear, the ghost is still there. When my grandchildren come to visit me, I often take them out to dinner at the Black Pelican, and invariably my grandson will say, 'This is so cool, we're going to the restaurant with the ghost.'" The Black Pelican is open year-round, except for Christmas and Thanksgiving. It is located at 3848 North Virginia Dare Trail. Chapter 6. Cobwebs on Your Face. Cupola House, Edenton, North Carolina. Edenton was the first colonial capital of North Carolina, and if the decision were to be based on quaintness, history, and beauty, it might still be the capital today. The enormous grant of land to the Lord Proprietor, the Earl of Granville, from the King of England, extended from the Carolina coast east almost as far as Charlotte. Unfortunately, Francis Corbin, whom Granville chose to administer this vast expanse of land, was an arrogant fellow who soon managed to antagonize not only the colony's leaders, but also two of its governors. Corbin built the lavish Cupola House for himself about 1758. Instead of purchasing the lot on which it stood in the name of his benefactor, he disregarded his instructions and bought it in his own name. Surely if the ambiance of a house is influenced by the personality of its first owner, something of that person's nature becomes some part of it. That is the way it may be with Cupola House, judging by the experiences of those who take care of it. But let us evaluate the gentleman for ourselves. Enter Mr. Corbin. As we join Francis Corbin in Colonial Edenton, he is standing in front of a tall gilt mirror, eyeing the press of his lace-trimmed shirt and appraising the cut of his coat. Both appear to please him, and the quality of his attire leaves no doubt that being a land agent is indeed a lucrative position. A discreet knock, and we see a servant enter his dressing room.
"Sir, the Moravian delegation is here."
"Good. Tell them I shall be there shortly and offer them a glass of ale."
Sharp German traders, though the Moravians were, Corbin was a step ahead of them. He had already heard from one of his western spies how much they wanted a certain large tract of land near the Yadkin River. Corbin smiled at the thought of his secret information that the Moravians were willing to pay considerably more than the price they had offered him. When Corbin met with them, his demand was double the land's worth. Lord Granville would get a paltry share of this sum, while the balance of the land agent's exorbitant price would line his own pockets. "But that is the way of the world," he said to himself, and that was the way Francis Corbin did business. It took only a few years before the colonists, indignant about his dishonest practices, organized a posse of armed citizens to seize Corbin and force him to promise reforms in the land office. Corbin's behavior had not only lost him Granville's support in England, but most of his own influence in the colony. He retained some in certain quarters, perhaps due to his marriage to a rich widow, but he was heartily disliked and no longer wielded power. Corbin stayed in the Cupola House when in Edenton until shortly before his death in 1767. Ironically, the over-budget, elaborate home built by him is today a National Historic Landmark, a house museum, and one of North Carolina's architectural treasures. Some say there is an eerie quality about this house. According to a lady who has done volunteer work for the Cupola House Association, "Sometimes events of a supernatural nature occur in the rooms of Cupola House, making people who work there uneasy.
Before a hurricane, we always go over to prepare the house. We place rags under doors, close shutters, take portraits off walls and place them on the beds, or bring in flower pots. But often, after a storm passes, when we go over to unlock the house, we find the key will not open the door. It appears that someone is standing on the other side trying to hold the door tightly closed. Just as strange is to find the bed on the second floor with a butt print on it, as if someone has been sitting there. This is unlikely because that room and the furniture in it is always kept roped off. Other strange events are described by another volunteer, a respected Edenton lady with a love for history. This is her story. A friend of mine, who has worked for a number of years for the Historical Edenton Association, and I received a warning that a hurricane was on the way. We immediately went up to work upstairs in the second-floor hallway of the couple house, preparing for the storm. During our preparations, we were both astonished to hear a piece of heavy furniture being dragged across the floor in the children's room at the rear of the house. We were alone in the house, and when we gathered enough courage to go to the back and enter the room, nothing had been moved. I had two other unsettling experiences. Again, a hurricane was on the way, and leaving the visitor center, I carried a strong flashlight, a new one, and hurried over to Cupola House, mounting the stairs to the third floor. I was standing behind a round drum-type enclosure containing a stairway, and I thought I should go up and raise the windows in the cupola just a little so that the wind would go through them. As I went up the stairs, the new flashlight I had brought went out. Returning to the visitor center, I found a second flashlight, tested it, and walked back over there. As soon as I mounted the stairs, that flashlight too went out. I admit that I was very nervous this time. The third flashlight worked. But strange things often happened in that house when I was alone or even when I conducted tours. When the group was quiet for a moment, I would sometimes hear the rustle and swish of taffeta, as if someone were walking past us in a long dress. This happened a couple of times, and it never ceased to give me chill bumps. I always wondered if it was the four Bond sisters who, after the death of their mother, lived on in this house until they died. In addition to the soft rustling sounds of women's skirts, and I almost hate to mention this, but occasionally I have had the most uncomfortable sensation of walking through cobwebs. I have felt them clinging stickily to my face or my arms, and yet none were visible. Of course, the Cupola House is regularly cleaned. The volunteer, who prefers to remain unnamed, says, I never mention such things as cobwebs or the sounds of furniture moving if I am conducting a tour. You know how nervous some people are about ghosts and the like. Cupola House is located at 408 South Broad Street. It is open daily for tours that leave from the visitor center at 108 North Broad Street. Cupola House is a National Historic Landmark, highly esteemed for its architectural significance. Chapter 7. Blackbeard's House. Hammock Street, Beaufort, North Carolina. Beaufort is a quaint coastal village that probably still looks much the way it did in the early 1700s. Pirates strutting down these narrow streets today would be at home. The old houses are similar to those built in the Bahamas by early mariners, and Blackbeard, who knew the Bahamas well, must have liked this small town. When he returned from his piratical expeditions, he would sail the Queen Anne's Revenge through the old channel into Beaufort Harbor and anchor her there, ready to keep any rendezvous at Ocracoke. Then he would head for the house where he and his crew stayed, Hammock House, known to this very day for its bloody history. A local girl knows the story well. We leaned against her shiny green sports utility vehicle and stared curiously at the white frame house, its roof extending the width of its narrow porch. In the year 2000, it was almost 3 centuries old. "That is the house that was once Blackbeard," she said. "My mother was a friend of the people who owned it, and when I was a child I stayed here and saw the stains on the stairs myself. It's called Hammock House now, but years ago people called it the Old White House. In the early days, it was a landmark for sailing ships. When sea captains sighted the house through their glasses, they would set their compasses by it and sail safely through the inlet and into the harbor. She knew her history well and relished telling it. Captain Edward Teach would stare out those front windows and watch the harbor lest a British sloop catch him unawares. It has been almost 3 centuries, yet some townspeople say they still feel the presence of one of history's most wicked pirates when they are near this house. Others claim they have heard peals of raucous laughter and drunken shouts resounding from the place on stormy nights. And who were the pirates who hung out here, obeying the commands of the ferocious Blackbeard? And it's noxious a band of rogues as you'll ever meet. You've probably heard of most of them and their fate. John Rose Archer, the adventurer's quartermaster, Thomas Miller, James Blake, Owen Roberts, the ship's carpenter from Wales, John Martin, Edward Salter, Richard Stiles, James White, and Captain Teach's most loyal man of all, Black Caesar. Here at Hammock House, the pirates entertained other buccaneers from along the coast, unaware that these revelries would be their last. In the fall of 1718, it would not be long before Blackbeard's crew would stand on a gallows at Williamsburg, Virginia, and feel the hemp of the hangman's noose rough against their necks. When Captain Edward Teach was not preying upon wealthy pilgrims bearing expensive gifts to Mecca, or seizing cargo vessels off the Atlantic and many other coasts, the fishing village of Beaufort was one of his favorite retreats. He and his crew relaxed here following their voyages, for during the cold winter months even the hardiest of pirates were often reluctant to go on account for their term of thievery on the high seas. This story, which came down through the townsfolk, is about just such a time. It is also about a lovely but rebellious local girl, Anne Gray, the pirate chieftain's sweetheart. Blackbeard was on his way to Beaufort from Philadelphia. As usual, he and his crew had enjoyed a bit of revelry at the Swede's place, a tavern at Marcus Hook, Pennsylvania, run by a woman called the Swede. After leaving her place, Captain Teach and his crew spent several days along the Delaware Capes, swapping stories with other pirate friends. But that was behind Teach now, and as his ship, the Queen Anne's Revenge, drew nearer to the Outer Banks, the pirate chief eagerly awaited the warm embrace of his current sweetheart, Anne Gray. She would be waiting for him at Hammock House in Beaufort, and pleased she would be with his gifts. As always, he brought back an ample amount of gold from ships he had seized, and from the sale of stolen cargo in the port cities of Boston, New York, and Philadelphia. Opening a woman's trunk on the day before he reached Beaufort, Blackbeard gloated over the contents. He had no recollection of the lady who had once owned it, nor how she had died. The other pirates could have what they wanted for their wives or sweethearts, but only after Anne had first choice, he thought. His fingers stroked dresses made of silk and cloth of gold from wealthy women who had turned them over gladly in exchange for their lives. A few had been reluctant to cooperate and were now at the bottom of the sea. Others, more sensible, were at least admiring the scenery on some deserted island, but whose fault was that? Surely not his. His mind went back to Anne, her beautiful long hair and ringlets around her forehead, and her smooth, fair skin. Why, he might even marry her some day. He certainly had nothing against the institution. Hadn't he already proven that by marrying a dozen women, or was it more? Stroking his beard, he tried to recall. Why did they always believe him so readily when he said, "I'm a single man"? Well, women always believe what they want to, he thought, smiling to himself. Perhaps he should go ahead and propose to her now. It was really nothing to him, and while he was away, it might keep her out of mischief, like the arms of another man. With that thought came a stab of jealousy, and he muttered various threats of what he would do if he ever caught her in the arms of some bloke. "I'll run the rascal through who touches her," he said to himself. As for Anne, It was better not to think what he would do to the soft flesh of that young lady. By now it was late afternoon. The wind and the weather had been with them all the way down the coast, and he was several days earlier than his sweetheart expected. What a fine surprise it would be for her. Back in Beaufort, almost at the same moment, Anne heard a knock at the back door of Hammock House, and, opening it, saw her father. As usual, he began pleading with her to come home. "Anne, you don't know how we worry about you, girl. These men are bad uns. Your mother and I fear for you when we hear how they treat women, and when we think of you with a ruffian like the likes of Blackbeard." Now Anne really lost her temper. "Go away. You and Mama are going to ruin my life. That ruffian, as you call him, has said he is going to make a fine lady of me. You'll see." "You ain't learned a bit of sense, Anne. Unless you turn your back on this wild life, the wages of sin may be death, as the good book says." "Oh, so now he's going to kill me, is that it?" She stamped her foot. "He wouldn't dare." "I didn't say that. I'm just afraid you'll bring it on yourself, girl, by keeping such bad company. It's not too late to come back home and back to God before you wind up in a pine box." There were tears in his eyes. "You can't scare me. Don't you know things have changed since you were young? If you ever were," she said, pushing him out and slamming the door. Then she leaned back against it, her heart pounding hard. Why didn't the old man leave her alone? This time he had really upset her more than she wanted him to know. What if he were right? She admitted to herself that she was beginning to fear Blackbeard and several of the men in his crew. But the thought of telling the pirate chieftain that she wanted to leave was a terrifying one. She had seen his rages. What would he do? She glanced at the beautiful emerald bracelet on her wrist. Sometimes she felt like a rabbit in a trap. She needed to do something to calm herself and give her an opportunity to think, so she did what she always did at such times. She filled her pockets with pieces of bread and went out to feed the gulls. She loved the gulls, and they were used to her coming to feed them each day. By the time she had tossed the last piece in the air, she had made up her mind. She wanted to go home. Yes, that was what she must do. Blackbeard and his crew were not due back yet, but something inside her was saying, "Go, go now." Should she leave that very day? Heaven knows she wanted to, but her pride made her refuse her father the satisfaction of seeing her return home a few hours after he had left Hammock House. Anne got into bed and began to cry bitterly when she remembered the tears in her father's eyes. She knew in her heart that her parents loved her, and she caught a glimpse of her own past foolishness as it vanished. Meanwhile, a short distance from Beaufort, Blackbeard's large hands with the thick black hair on the back raised a spyglass, and he stared out from under his bushy brows at the familiar white house. He would soon be there. No large ships were anchored at the Beaufort dock today, only a few fishing boats. Breathing a sigh of satisfaction, he set his compass by the house, more out of habit than anything else. He knew this inlet so well he could run it blindfolded. At the house, Anne was already up and dressed. She ate a bowl of porridge, and then, as she began packing her clothes, she heard a knock at the back door. Was it her father? She hoped so, for then she would go back with him. She called down, "Come in," and heard footsteps mount the stairs. To her surprise, it was Samuel, the young farmer and fisherman who had once given her a present of a ring with the tiniest of stones, but all he could afford. When Blackbeard had seen it, he roared with laughter and pitched it over the side of his ship. Reaching into a chamois bag at the waist, he said, "Hold out your hand," and she saw a glint of green and gold as he dropped a ring with an enormous emerald into her outstretched palm. Now, as she looked at Samuel, whom she had not seen in months, she remembered the ring he had wanted her to have. He was like her parents, she thought, content with the simplest of things. To be back from the sea, to be in his own little house, and in church of a Sunday. She was surprised at how happy she was that he was here. "You know I still want to marry you. Do you really love that man, Anne?" asked Samuel. With his finger, he tilted her chin up and looked deep into her eyes. She leaned against him and cried like a child. "No, Sam, no. Sometimes I'm so afraid of him." "Well, why do you come to his house, then?" "Because of the jewelry and fine clothes he gave me. My friends in Beaufort were impressed when they saw Blackbeard admired me."
"Didn't your mother warn you about him?"
"Yes, but I thought she was jealous and angry because I wouldn't be there to help her, that she didn't want me to have a life of my own."
"Oh, no, Anne, that's not so. She wants you to have a fine life, not a life of being knocked around. In town, they say they saw you with bruises on your face and arms."
"That is true, but he swore he would never hit me again."
"A man who strikes a woman once will do it again."
Her lips trembled, and she looked down.
"Anne," persisted Samuel, "this man murders innocent people and gives you the jewels warm from their bodies. Is that what you want to wear?"
A blush colored her face.
"Oh, no, no."
She walked restlessly around the room and toward the window. He followed.
"Just tell me one thing. Do you love me, Anne?"
"Yes, but when it began, you were away on a whaling trip."
"I was coming back when, with money, honest earned," said Samuel.
Anne looked out to the waterfront and gave a sudden start.
"What is the matter?" he asked.
"He's back! Oh, Sam, he's coming now!"
And there he was. Striding up toward the house came the tall, swaggering figure that seaports throughout the world knew as the most terrifying pirate of them all, Blackbeard.
"I'll hide you," she cried out desperately, and caught at Samuel's arm. He pulled away.
"I can defend myself," he said, his hand on his knife. "He's alone, and I'm going down to meet him."
Unable to stop the young fisherman, Anne gave a little scream of protest, and, turning, dropped to the ground through a raised window at the back of the house. Samuel was halfway down the stairs when the front door opened. The brawny, broad-shouldered figure filled the doorway, and for an instant Blackbeard stared up at him. Then the pirate let fly a stream of the most awful curses, as, eyes blazing, he charged up the stairs like an enraged bull elephant. With one sweep of his cutlass, the pirate struck, and Samuel fell across the stairs, mortally wounded. A crimson stream spurted from the slash across his throat onto the stairs. People who have lived in that house say they have often tried to wash away the stains where Blackbeard killed the young man. But the splotches, dark as dried blood, return.
"That is just what I saw years ago," said the girl.
"And what of Anne Gray?" "They say that Anne was found washed ashore near Beaufort. She had been stabbed to death and thrown into the ocean. Villagers believed that Blackbeard himself had killed her. And gossip in the town had it that even before her body was found, Anne's emerald bracelet and ring were being worn by another, a new girl who had taken the pirate's fancy. Today, near the water, the gulls still soar and squawk, 'Gree, gree, gree,' the same cry they made the day they swooped down over Anne while she lay upon the beach, a poor, foolish girl who would hear them no more." The house that Captain Edward Teach made his headquarters for a time is now a private residence. Although there is a sign in front to identify it, the house is not open to the public. Chapter 8. The Phantom Ship, Beaufort, North Carolina. It was the last of August, and Captain John Sabiston's ship was back in the busy port of Beaufort. This was not the first time Sabiston had noticed the girl among the crowd of villagers who came down to meet the ships when they sailed into Beaufort. She was taller than most of the women and held herself proudly. Her chestnut hair was streaked gold by the sun. Annie liked the way she moved, with grace and vitality, a look of eager anticipation on her face. As he walked along the dock, he found himself headed directly toward her and passed so close that his large duffel bag brushed the sky-blue chambray of her dress.
"Pardon me, ma'am," he said.
"It's quite all right, sir." Her voice was breathless. "Have you seen Robert Chadwick?"
"He was one of the first off."
"Then he is already on his way home," she said, a quick smile lighting up her face. "Thank you," she said, and turning away, walked quickly through the crowd. An unusually attractive young woman, thought the captain, who told himself Chadwick was a lucky fellow. But marriage and the sea don't always mix, and Saviston reflected that it was not for him. As his friends had so often told him, "You are married to the sea and your ship." He had heard that in Greece, a man taking command of a vessel for the first time would hang a crown of laurel leaves on the ship. It was the custom in that country for the bride to wear a crown of laurel upon the exchange of her wedding vows. Captain Saviston was approaching 30 and had been captain of his own vessel for a year. This morning, as he looked about him, he saw his friend Captain Ireland, and the two men greeted each other warmly. Ireland asked where he would be staying, and when Saviston admitted he had no idea, Ireland invited him to be his house guest. Since he would be in port a week or more while his schooner was unloading and preparing for her next voyage, Saviston accepted gladly. Captain Ireland's wife, Jane, was an accomplished musician as well as a good cook, and Captain Saviston's visit promised to be even more pleasant than he expected, as he and Ireland, whom he had known but casually, discovered shared interests. Both were students of botany, and enjoyed taking long walks together while Saviston acquired considerable information about the plant life of the southern coast. The second night Saviston was in port, Mrs. Ireland had a party, and for the first time Saviston met many of the townspeople socially rather than primarily as customers for his cargo, or as merchants who stocked his vessel with supplies for the next voyage. Chadwick was there with a girl who had been looking for him at the dock, and they joined the captain as he stood listening to Mrs. Ireland play the harpsichord. "I'm glad to see you again, Captain," said Chadwick. "I think from my conversation and letters to her that Mattie here already knows our paths have crossed in various ports. Mattie, this is Captain Saviston." Saviston bowed courteously, yet felt strangely ill at ease and inwardly blamed his awkwardness upon his months at sea with only the rough men of a ship's crew for company. "How do you do, Mrs. Chadwick?" Mattie looked surprised, and Chadwick spoke quickly. "I'm sorry, sir. I thought you knew I am unmarried. Mattie is my sister." The captain gazed at her. "I see, and I'm most happy to meet you, ma'am." "Beaufort is my home port," explained Chadwick, "and I'm always glad to put in here to see my sister and widowed mother." It was apparent that the captain was quite taken with Mattie, for he stood there staring at her with obvious approval and scarcely seemed to hear Chadwick's words. Mrs. Ireland noticed this with a woman's perception and, rising from the piano, whisked them away to seats at the dining-room table. She placed the captain and Mattie on her right, and before long the two were engaged in animated conversation. During the following weeks, Mattie joined Captain Saviston and Captain Ireland on their daily nature walks, and at night Saviston often called upon her at the Chadwick home. All ideas of laurel wreaths, as the symbol of a captain's marriage to his ship, were soon forgotten. Captain Saviston proposed, and he and Mattie were married before he went on his next voyage back to Baltimore. On these trips his ship was filled with hides, fish, tar, pitch, and turpentine from Carolina, as well as tea, spices, rope, and cloth that had arrived in the Beaufort port from abroad. John and Mattie were happy together, their marriage blessed with children, and the years passed quickly. Each time Saviston's three-masted schooner would sail into the harbor on its return from Baltimore, he would anchor in the same place. Mattie could see it from her window, and, scarcely able to contain her happiness, she would run down to the dock to greet him. When his ship, the Esmeralda, was due in port, she would hurry to open the drapes each morning and stare out at the harbor, hoping to see its sails, with the salmon-tinted glow of the sunrise, behind them. And then one September dawn, it was there. From her window, she saw the vessel lying at anchor, the sun glinting on its brass fittings, the ship's sleek lines a joy to behold. Her husband stood beside the mizzenmast, looking toward the house as if he knew she was at the window. She saw him raise an arm and wave. Mattie's heart quickened within her. Snatching up a small shawl, she opened the window and waved, but he did not wave again. Dressing quickly, she hurried down to the dock to greet him. But to her amazement, the schooner was not there, nor was it anywhere in the harbor. As her eyes searched the waterfront, she saw her brother just stepping over on the dock from his own vessel. His lean, tanned face was grave, and immediately she knew something was wrong. He put his arm around her. "Maddie, I don't know how to break the news to you, but I must. John's ship went down in a storm." "No, I just saw it," cried Maddie. "It was right in the place where he always anchors. The ship I saw was John's. Where has it gone?" "You couldn't possibly have seen the Esmeralda, sister, or John either. We were separated during a nor'easter, and near dusk, when the wind abated, I saw him through my glasses to the south of us. We set our sails to overtake him, but the sea was still rough, and the waves towered above my ship. I saw the Esmeralda rise from a trough to the crest, and then fall back on its side, as if felled by some monstrous hand. It sank so rapidly, no one could help them."
"But his ship, it was out in the harbor this morning, in its usual place. Maddie, you can't have seen it. The Esmeralda will never anchor in Beaufort Harbor again," her brother said sadly. Maddie began to sob wildly, and then to berate the sea. "Why did the sea snatch him away? I hate you, I hate you, I hate you," she cried, looking across the water. "Hush, Maddie, hush," said her brother, holding her to him until her cries died away and became soft, anguished moans. "But how could I have seen his ship this morning?" "My dear, you can only have seen a phantom ship sailed by a crew from another world." "No, it was John," said Maddie Sabiston. She took a deep breath and strained her shoulders. "He came back for one last goodbye," she said quietly, and walked toward the house. Chapter 9. The Ghost of Fort Macon, Morehead City, North Carolina. If you were one of the men on the staff of Fort Macon, how would you like to have a ghost single you out as his favorite ranger? That is exactly what seems to be happening to Paul Branch, historian at one of North Carolina's most historic forts, a fort upon which he has lavished hour upon hour of his life as he researches and records its fascinating history. Branch's book, Fort Macon, should not be judged on the basis of accounts of the number of battles fought at the fort, heroic episodes during the shelling, or any overwhelming victories. Instead, it is the story of this fort's vital location and a change that occurred here in modern warfare as revolutionary as the development of the Winchester rifle. It was only the second time in history that rifled cannons would be used to breach the walls of a fort. This scoring or rifling inside the barrel of the guns made them considerably more accurate and more deadly than ever before. But back to our story of Officer Branch's ghostly admirer. It was early spring of 1861 when a farm boy named Ben Combs was considering leaving Goldsboro, North Carolina, to join the Confederate Army. His father saw no sense to it at all and told him so. "You don't know nothing about soldiering, boy. You're a farmer. You got patience with animals, and you got an eye for plowing a straight row. But lately you stand around doing nothing but chewing tobacco and looking off in the distance. I figure you got to be doing some powerful thinking because you moving so slow." "I ain't fast like you, Pa, because I ain't used to making decisions yet. But they'll learn me that in the..." "Go ahead and say it."
"You mean the Army."
"Yes, I'm thinking that I want to join up, Pa. The Yankees are going to invade our state, and the boys from Goldsboro are forming companies and offering them to the governor."
"Your Ma's not going to take to this, but I see you got your mind set on it," said his father. And join up Ben Combs did. Many of the soldiers from both North and South were like him. They were store clerks, shoemakers, teachers, sailors, fishermen, and farm boys who didn't know what soldiering was all about. Ben heard that President Lincoln had asked the governor of North Carolina to send troops to attack South Carolina because they had seceded. He knew North Carolina wasn't about to do such a thing, and they wouldn't till the bad place froze over. Ben was
soon at Fort Macon with the Goldsboro Volunteers and the Goldsboro Rifles. He knew many of the boys that were already there, and they regarded it as a great adventure, the most exciting thing they had ever done in their lives. None of them had any idea of the desperate struggle that lay ahead. Everyone was digging like crazy, hurrying to level the sand dunes that stood between Fort Macon and the water so they would have a clear field to fire on the Yankees when they landed to try to take the fort. Ben found the digging hard work, but no harder than working with his pa on the farm, and his spirits, like those of the other men, were high. On the night of May 21st, news came that North Carolina, too, had finally seceded from the Union, and that brought on a wild demonstration. Men shouted and cheered, and at the end of the announcement they all began to sing Dixie and the Old North State Forever. While I live, I will cherish, protect, and defend her. Hurrah, hurrah, the Old North State Forever, sang Ben. He knew he would protect North Carolina from northern invasion, even at the risk of his life. He enjoyed learning the military life at the fort. The drills, target practice, where he once got best shot, and the talk with his comrades about how they were going to defend Morehead City. He had already decided that when the Yankees were defeated and the war was over, he would like to stay in the army and be stationed here at Fort Macon. It was never lonely or dull like at the farm at Goldsboro had been, and he enjoyed watching the ships come and go in the harbor. He often walked along or sat upon the wall, staring northeast toward Beaufort, or west toward the harbor and Morehead City, anticipating the direction the Yankees would come from. When the attack finally came in the spring of 1862, Ben worked desperately to mount a special cannon with a 10-inch mortar shell. A fuse was cut too long, and the shell rolled right toward him. The farm boy, who had never been faced with a danger like this before, did not move quickly enough to get out of the way. He froze. Finally he ran, but it was too late. The shell seemed to pursue him like some evil demon, and when it finally caught up with him, it exploded in his back, shattering his rib cage. There was nothing the fort surgeon could do, for the broken ribs had punctured his lungs. During the several days that he lived on, Ben's pain was excruciating. He thought about home. None of the boys back in Goldsboro had ever told him war could be like this. After the Civil War was over, the Outer Banks lapsed back into their quiet, almost prehistoric isolation. There was a flurry of activity at Fort Macon during the Spanish-American War, but it was followed by long years when the fort lay abandoned in a state of decay. Its brick sidewalks were crumbling, the parade ground was overgrown with brush, and its walls were shrouded with vines. The fort fell prey to vandals. When Officer Paul Branch arrived at Fort Macon in June of 1981, he became fascinated with its history. He had heard rumors of the fort's ghost, but paid little heed to them until strange incidents began happening to him. He soon found out that no one wanted to be asked to work alone inside the fort at night. He thought it ridiculous until one evening, after he had been completing some research in his office and was ready to leave, he turned the knob of the door, only to find himself locked in from the outside. This was one of a series of incidents that caused him to regard the story of the ghost more seriously. Numerous times at night when the fort is deserted and someone is alone in the office, or two officers are working together, the clap of a door firmly closing is heard. Since only one man was killed in battle here, whenever a particularly incredible incident happens, the men at the fort have fallen into the habit of calling the ghost by the name of Ben. Probably one of the strangest experiences happened to Ranger Branch himself. He was out on the drill ground in the center of the fort on a bright sunny day and happened to notice two of the men assigned to the post sitting on the wall. He had first noticed them because of the long shadows their figures cast. A moment later he glanced back at them, trying to recall their names. They still sat there, but this time, below them on the wall, and in approximately the same position, was a third shadow, also that of a man, but only the same two men were sitting on the wall above. Their positions were unchanged. Men stationed at the fort say it is not unusual for objects customarily kept in one place to appear in some remote and bizarre spot. Doors have been known to close behind officers who were walking down a corridor when the headquarters building was empty. Once, one of the officers saw the door to his own office close, although the hall outside the door was empty. Visitors touring the fort occasionally report strange experiences, but Officer Branch says reassuringly that he has never known of the ghost harming anyone. As dusk descends on Fort Macon in the year 2000, 139 years after North Carolina seceded from the Union, you can hear the pounding of the surf, just as the men did when they were stationed here in 1861 and 1862. If we listen attentively, is it possible to hear Ben Combs' ardent young voice raised in song, just as it was the night the fort received the news of secession? While I live, I will cherish, protect, and defend her. Hurrah, hurrah, the old North State forever. Ben had wanted to defend his state with all his heart. So don't be startled when you visit Fort Macon, if Ben's unseen hand closes the door behind you, or if you count the officers and see an extra shadow figure on the wall. Like many of the men and women who serve at Fort Macon State Park today, you may soon believe that Ben's spirit is still here. Fort Macon State Park is the only state park with a military fort. It is also one of North Carolina's top attractions and has one of the highest number of visitors of any North Carolina state park. For more information, phone 252-726-3775. I'm going to skip ahead to chapter 12 so we can fit it in for this session, and then I'll double back on our next session. This is chapter 12, Ghost of the Old Firehouse, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Broadway at the Beach, Restaurant Row, The Pavilion. Visitors don't think of ghosts in connection with the glitter of the Grand Strand. The story of a tall, intelligent man, now prominent in Myrtle Beach civic life, may make us change our minds. Former fireman John Simpson says, "I had an experience in the old firehouse that I will carry with me forever. It is immaterial to me whether anyone believes it or not. I was stationed at the old firehouse on 13th Avenue," says John. "That station was an isolated place, not like the one we have now, and I'm glad. The building now serves as a warehouse for the city of Myrtle Beach. At the time, I worked nights, and the fireman who worked with me, B.J., was a friend of several years standing, but we began to have a real disagreement over something that was happening. Night after night, we would hear footsteps and then the sound of one of the bay doors being opened. We would rush out of our room to see who was doing it, but no one was ever there. The grounds around the station were clear of other buildings and bushes, so that if anyone was running away, we would have seen him immediately. We first thought someone was playing tricks on us. The controls were electric, the buttons were on the inside, and you had to press one and hold it down to open the bay door. If you turned the button loose, the door would go back up. We would hear the sound of it descending and go out to check, only to find it suspended in midair. That means it was either stuck in place, or someone whom we could not see was standing there holding the button down with an invisible finger. Then we looked for a way it could have jammed, perhaps something wedged in supporting it there, such as a piece of wood, but nothing was ever found. In the daytime, the door worked fine. It would only descend at night. Some of us figured that we knew who was doing it, and I thought I was pretty sure who the ghost was. I thought of what I had heard all my life, that the reason people return to a place is because they have unfinished business to complete. Now, there had been a man named Burns working outside the fire station, connecting some electrical wires that led to the building. He got too close to a live wire, and they said that he was drawn toward that wire like a magnet. Someone looked out, and there he was, hanging among the wires. We tried to rescue him, and one of the strangest things was that although he was in the midst of a tangle of live wires that had not been shut off yet from the main line, not one of us working to rescue him was injured. Another thing we didn't understand was that this guy had been wiring buildings for some 20 years and never had a problem. They said he was an expert and had done some of the most dangerous jobs anyone could do. He took real pride in his work. How could his performing a simple task get him electrocuted? I believed he was back because he simply had not finished. He had begun the electrical work and died before completing what he set out to do. The ghost had to be this fellow named Burns. BJ and I would hear that door creak as the ghost descended late at night, and both of us would hurry out of the bedroom to check. Although we never found a natural explanation for it, BJ always said there was no such thing as a ghost being the cause. Then my friend BJ died from a heart attack. One night a few weeks later, I was shocked and frightened when I saw him standing right in the room with me, just like he used to there at the fire station. He spoke quite clearly, saying, "Johnny, I want to tell you that I believe your story about the other man who died here. I believe it now for reasons that I cannot explain to you because I'm not in your world anymore." I told a friend of mine about it who was present when BJ appeared, but neither he nor any of the other men saw or heard anything. He asked how I knew who it was. I told him I knew it was BJ because I could see him clearly, but I couldn't say a word. I think I was being prevented from exposing him because he was speaking only to me. "What was he wearing?" someone asked, and I said he was wearing his fireman's uniform. The last thing I heard him say to me was, "Let's go." When he said, "Let's go," I'm looking like, what does he mean? Is he taking me with him? I didn't need that. Or is he speaking to someone with him that I'm unable to see? But I finally put two and two together. Apparently, BJ was talking to a companion. My dead friend had come back to let me know that what I had witnessed and what he had so often disputed me about was the truth. He must have been speaking to the guy who had held his finger on the button that lowered the bay door. When he said, "Okay, let's go," it was to his ghostly companion and not me. Realizing that, I breathed a sigh of relief, for I was not eager to accompany him. From that day on, I felt very comfortable when I was in the station by myself. That building of metal, wood, and brick still stands, shabbier with age. Sometimes I glance over at it when I pass and wonder if the two men are at peace. On the other hand, are they just waiting for someone else to occupy the building so they may roam it once more when the sun sets and the shadows cluster around it after dark? The old fire station is at 701 13th Avenue South. We've run out of time for more chapters of Ghosts from the Coast, a ghostly tour of coastal North Carolina and South Carolina by Nancy Roberts. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Joyner, reading for the Triangle Reading Service. So long until next time.